Greetings and welcome to The Thirsty Mage, the podcast that had to celebrate the spooky season with a defining game in the Metroidvania genre, Symphony of the Night. I'm your host for this episode, Jordan Rudek, and tonight we dive deep into a game from 1997 that debuted on the original PlayStation. While other titles of that era experimented with 3D gameplay, like Crash Bandicoot and, of course, Final Fantasy VII, some kept up the pixelated look of their predecessors. And this is one podcast that likes it some pixel art. Before we proceed any further into Dracula's castle, let's find out who will be joining me on this haunted adventure. First up is a man who is so new to the Castlevania series that he thought hearts would refill his hit points. It's David Lloyd.
Well, I just thought that was the standard in the video game industry. That's an honest mistake.
Yep. It's an honest mistake for sure. Yeah, hearts usually mean hit points. I don't know what Konami was thinking when they instituted that series staple of hearts being your sub-weapon refill. But
I can't say it was all that intuitive.
It makes sense that food gives you health, right?
Yeah, that stands to reason. It's funny. I was just thinking of that. I'm just like, what would they replace it with if it wasn't hearts, I guess? Yeah. But yeah, food's probably the best. But then they had food, so.
Sure.
I don't know. Maybe they just couldn't decide. But like you were telling me before, this is something that's been there since the beginning. So I guess it's on me.
Yep, since the very first Castlevania game back on NES, a classic still, I think, got remade for Super Nintendo effectively and Super Castlevania. All of those games, I think, had turkeys in the walls or other apples, I think, could be another food item you pick up. There's a lot of different food items in Symphony of the Night, but we'll get to those. Also making his debut on the podcast is longtime patron turned contributor, who I'm going to dub as our resident horror expert, and that's Chris Reed.
Hey, I just have to say that the only thing I'm really can call myself an expert on is getting turned to stone by the Medusa heads in this game. They just nailed me every single time, and it just without yep. fail.
I imagine that we're all probably experts in that after going through this game. That is definitely a tricky section of the castle.
If my PS5 controller wasn't $100, I would have threw it at the wall.
Yeah,
I almost threw mine at the wall. My PlayStation 4 controller, the jump button was starting to stick during this game. And so that made that part fun. But it's a pleasure to be here, guys. Thanks for having me on.
The thing that I noticed, or that I'm really liking about my hosting job here, is that when we get a new guest on the podcast and their name is super easy, I'm the one who's hosting, right? It's not someone's name that we have trouble pronouncing, and David's going to butcher it before we get anything started. So that's a less than fortuitous start to the podcast, maybe. Yep. David?
No, I was just going to say that's almost like someone planned it that way. I don't know.
Can't imagine who would have done that.
Yeah.
I think I signed up for podcasting before I even knew Chris was on the podcast. Yeah. So for all I knew, you could have brought in some horror experts and really thrown me for a loop.
Yeah.
I mentioned, you know, we're in the Halloween season, right? Like this podcast is going to go up just before or just around Halloween, Halloween night, which is, we're recording on a Wednesday, Halloween is Sunday. So I figured, I don't have an Oreo cookie to talk about tonight, but I did want to bring up just a small question to you guys, and I'll answer it, of course, myself. Your favorite Halloween candy, you know, when you were trick-or-treating, I don't know if you still do that. If you still do that at your age, but maybe with the kiddos. Is there a particular treat, you know, back when you were collecting them that you always wanted to see in your bag? What was your go-to? And I'm not talking about full-size, you know, going to a convenience store or supermarket and buying your own. Like, what mini-size one did you really want to see, your neighbors throwing in your Halloween bag?
Well, why do you have to stop at the mini size? The whole point of Halloween is to go to the rich people's neighborhood to get the king size bars all the time.
And just it's true. It's true. The king size was definitely, but you might get a king size of something you didn't really like, and then it's like, it's kind of all for naught, you know.
That's
like
true. That's where the trading game comes in, and you see your friends and like you trade which ones you don't want. But anyway, for me, it has to be the peanut M&Ms. The little bags are just perfect.
Okay. Yeah. That's a good call. David, what about you?
I was also always partial to the mini Mars bars myself.
That or Snickers. The caramel and nougat is very, very satisfying, very filling in those ones. I agree.
Yep.
I'll throw out one that wasn't very common, but you'd sometimes get it up here, and that's the Baby Ruth. Baby Ruth, I don't know that they really sell it in Canada. Sometimes you do get it in the Halloween packs, but Baby Ruth a little bit different. It's a little bit sweeter on the inside. You know, obviously I'm going to go for that. But maybe for something more basic, I liked Smarties. Like, I've always preferred Smarties to M&M's. And I don't know, Chris, if they have Smarties in the States, if that's just a Canadian and a British thing.
I believe we have Smarties down here. Usually if we were to get those in our bag, that would be the house that was asking for eggs or toilet paper. So they were good markers. Yeah.
Good to know. Yeah, okay, cool. What about drinks? David, what do you got for us tonight?
Well, I know this is the Halloween special, and I know for years I've always figured that Halloween would be the last stand or the last wall, last line of defense to hold Christmas off from the rest of the calendar year. But Halloween has failed, and every store that I've ever walked into in the past week has all been about Christmas and the holly jollies and all that stuff. And so I was in the grocery store, and they're already stocking eggnog. And now usually I wouldn't worry about it. It's not a big deal. But as a vegan, if you don't get the stuff early, it's gone and it never comes back. So I had to pick up this year's eggnog, the ones that aren't dairy, like the vegan eggnog. You could quickly end up with like some of the crappier versions. So I actually saw a new one this year that I haven't seen before. And this one is the oat nog. So this is an oat-based eggnog, which is essentially, it's like oat milk, and it has your usual suspects for like vegan milk, which would be like the seaweed, the carnagenian or whatever they call it, that you see in like chocolate milk. And then this one also has like nutmeg and your traditional spices. So as eggnog goes, it was pretty good. Like, most of the time with vegan eggnog, I can't find that I can just like pour it in a glass and drink it. It's usually got some like a strong flavor one way or another, to the point where it's like I gotta mix it with something else, whether it's like watering it down with some almond milk or something. But this one was actually pretty good. It was all completely drinkable, and I also pour a little bit into my barista milk when I'm making a latte. So I've already started the eggnog latte. So. If the rest of the world is going to tarnish Halloween by jumping on the bandwagon, the Christmas bandwagon early, it's inevitable. We just have to ride this wave for now on.
We could also take a stand and say that we're not going to drink eggnog until after November 1st. But I guess you've got a good excuse though, because if you don't indulge now, they're going to be all out of the eggnogs that you can actually drink. So yeah. I think that that's a very good reason to actually start hoarding your oat nog early. Would you normally mix eggnog or oat nog with a particular liqueur, cognac, brandy, something like that? Is that something you do, or you just go straight?
It's not a tradition, but I've done it before, and it's cognac is my my poison of choice for mixing with eggnog. Right. But it wouldn't be... Like, it's not something I do every year. It'd be more like if I thought of it, or if there was company over that specifically wanted it or something to that effect. But it's not.
And then you would indulge too.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right. Chris, what about you?
Yeah, well, just to keep the wrong holiday discussion going, a few years ago, my wife and her family got me a Nespresso machine as a Christmas present. Because I wasn't a big fan of, the Keurig pods. I didn't think they tasted very well, and I was getting tired of... I was getting lazy and not wanting to use my fresh press very often. So they got me an espresso machine, and it's really nice. The coffee is quite excellent tasting on it with a bunch of different flavors. So one of the ones I'm drinking tonight is their decaf version. They call it. They all have pretentious names like decaffeinato and stuff like that. But it's got really rich flavor and no caffeine, so I'm going to fall asleep like normal tonight.
Right up your alley, Jordan.
I'm incredulous that someone else would bring decaf to the podcast. I'm thrilled about it, actually. Chris, do you normally drink, full calf in the morning and then decaf if you had a coffee later in the day, something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I try to follow, I think it's the Italian rule, or you drink coffee before noon and then afternoon before 3 an espresso, if anything, and then after that, only decaf. Right. So I'm not sure how well that actually worked, but, it's a good taste, and it is calming at the end of the day.
you've given yourself rules to follow. If the rules work out, that's fantastic. If they don't, you know, you can blame the Italians. It's not
exactly
your fault.
Right. Projecting.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure the Canadian rule is three lattes a day is all right. I'm fairly confident that's the case.
David, have you tried any of the lattes from Tim's? Like, we've been going to Tim's a lot more because they had Roll Up the Rim a few weeks ago. It's over now, but and then the Starbucks near me has been under renovation, so I've kind of made the switch, at least temporarily. Have you tried any of their lattes? They seem to have a lot of new flavors, but also a lot more non-dairy milk choices too.
I haven't tried their non-dairy one. Like, when they first came out with lattes, must have been 6 or 7 years ago now. I remember I got one back then, and I thought it was disgusting because it wasn't.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I don't know what was going on. Like, the milk, it wasn't real milk. It was like some kind of weird sub. Like, I don't know if it was like some kind of condensed milk that they added water to at the time, like when they hit the button, or if it was like, I don't know what was going on with their milk. I know they changed it since then because they actually make like a real latte now, so it's probably better. But it's I haven't gone to a Tim Hortons. It's usually when I'm out. What's funny is that the cafe I go to actually uses the same soy brand that I do. So it's usually when you go out and you pay an $8 for latte, you think you're getting something a little bit more upscale than what you're making at home. But it's just paying for the luxury of having it out on the road, I guess, now.
I was going to say, since my local Starbucks has been under renovation, I've been feeling like a rich man because I'm not drinking $7 or $8 coffees anymore. I'm down to my extra large decaf at Tim's is like $2.50 maximum, $2 something, right? Plus I'm getting points, and every seventh coffee or so is free. So yeah, I'm feeling, you know, the pocketbook's a little bit not so light as it used to be. So I'm kind of happy about that. But we'll see if the change sticks around. I'll try some of the lattes, maybe report back in a week or two. You know, we're not here to talk about lattes and decaffeinados and oat nog all night. We do have a symphony to get to.
Back to Halloween.
yes, exactly. Too many treats. Let's go back to the tricks. Yep. Symphony of the Night, Castlevania game. It was directed by Toru Hagihara, who had previously worked on Castlevania II Belmont's Revenge on Game Boy, which I believe is available as part of the Castlevania Anniversary Collection. He also worked on Rondo of Blood for the PC Engine, or as we might know it, the TurboGrafx-16. Rondo of Blood is also available in the Castlevania Requiem pack that David and I played for this episode. Mm-hmm. Chris, what did you play Symphony of the Night originally on PlayStation, or did you come to it in a re-release somewhere?
I played it many years ago when I first got a PlayStation 2 with the backwards compatibility, but that was over 15 years ago. And so I just played it again recently using that same double pack on the PlayStation 4.
Right on, yeah. The timing actually worked out because I think it was Paige who actually suggested we play this game. She's not here tonight, but she suggested we play the game, and then David turned us on to a sale. The game was 55 or 60% off on the PlayStation Store, so that was pretty good. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the game, though, of course, Koji Igarashi, the kind of, I don't know if you call him like the godfather of Castlevania or something like that, but... Certainly the creator of the Igavania games. He was involved with Symphony of the Night as assistant director. He had some other roles as well. He would go on, of course, to produce titles in the GBA for the GBA and the Nintendo DS, those trios. And then more recently, the Kickstarted game Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, which we've mentioned on this podcast but haven't talked about at length yet. After a brief prologue, this is when the game starts proper, after a brief prologue that actually involves Richter Belmont and the ending of Rondo of Blood, which is kind of a neat thing that happens there, a time jump occurs before we see Alucard, who is Dracula's son. Alucard is racing towards Dracula's castle. He is kind of, you know, almost immediately, there's a couple of rooms of fighting before he is stripped of all his equipment. And from there, he must explore the castle, regain his powers, and toughen up before the final battle, or perhaps battles with an S might be more appropriate. David, we'll start with you. What are your impressions of the game? I think it's, I've really wanted to hear from you because, again, this, and I know you've been enjoying it just from your tweets and kind of a dialogue in Slack and Discord. But, you know, it's your first Castlevania game. For that to happen with something as good as this game is really, really cool. So, yeah, how did you find the game overall?
I'm absolutely shocked how good it is. Like, it's one of those games where you hear forever. Like, I heard... You always hear people talk about, like, Metroidvania fans or Castlevania fans. They're always talking about how great Symphony Knight is. Like, you always see the top 10 lists, and it's always, like, either one or two. It's always up high there. And I've dabbled in Castlevania. I won't claim to have really played one, because usually what happens is I'll try out Castlevania for about 20 minutes, hate it, and then not play it again. I've done that for a bunch of them. They usually feel too slow, and... just feel kind of, I don't know, I like kind of running around in speed and the RPG elements and everything. And so, you know, like you said, Paige had mentioned doing like a Halloween themed game. And it's funny, I actually had purchased Symphony of Night years ago on my PlayStation 3. So I actually did have it on older PlayStation. But I was kind of hemming and hawing.
Yeah, I've got it on Vita as well, I'm pretty sure. Like, downloaded on my Vita, but just never got to it.
Yeah, because it's a PS1 classic, so I was like, you know, I could play it on that. But then when I saw that sale for $10, I'm like, screw it, let's play it on the PlayStation 5. Looks incredible, plays incredible. Like, it doesn't... This feels different. Like, I'm sure somebody's going to, you know, tell me that I'm crazy. It's a lot like a lot of the other Castlevanias, but this one felt much faster to me. It felt... a lot more engaging. The like running through the castle and exploring felt great. I loved the way that, like you said, at the beginning of the game, Alucard is stripped of everything by death, and you feel weak. Like you're fighting along and you're kind of trudging through, and you get to certain areas that are a little bit tougher than others, but because of the RPG elements, you're kind of rewarded for being kind of slow and methodical, because you're slowly powering up, and all of a sudden, like, those areas that were hard before are just a cakewalk now. I didn't realize, like, all of the fun little quirks of the game, like, the skeletons that throw boomerangs are kind of, like, they're on the side of the wall with, like, it looks like that they got their leg up and they're smoking a cigarette waiting for, like, you know, just kind of standing around waiting for something to happen. Like, it's hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just so many fine details in it. Like the, you know, when you find the confessional and you can sit in either chair, and if you sit too long, you'll just fall asleep. And, you know, you can play the role as the priest, and you can, like, sit there and listen to someone. And sometimes the person that comes will actually stab you. Like, it's just, oh my God, there's just so many great things. The music blew me away. Mm-hmm. Like, I was shocked by, like, I go into a new room and all of a sudden, like, an electric guitar breaks out. And I'm like, holy moly, this is awesome. Like, it's just, this isn't a genre that I really care for. Like, I've played a lot of Metroids and... not a big fan of Metroid, and like I said, played Castlevanias before, so it's kind of turned me off of the Metroidvania. But then now I'm like, man, if there's anything like this out there in this genre, I'll play it, because this is a whole lot of fun.
Well, as I mentioned, Igarashi's put out at least six games on GBA and Nintendo DS, three of which just came to Switch, actually, or came everywhere. The Castlevania Advance Collection. So maybe we'll be able to dive into that next. I totally agree with everything you're saying. I think the one of the funny things was the CD kind of loading rooms, right? You get those little corridors where you go through, and it has a little CD, letter CD at the top middle of the screen. But the cool thing about those rooms is you knew when you got from one end to the next, the music was going to change. And so you could really look forward to what the new music was going to be, maybe in an area you hadn't been in before. I just thought thought those rooms were hilarious that they're still in this version of the game when obviously, you know, we don't really have this game probably wouldn't need loading times or anything like that. It wouldn't need to, certainly not like the PlayStation 1 might need, yep. Right? So, Chris, what about you? How did you, maybe your initial impressions of the game when you first played it and then a little bit of, you know, in this replay?
Yeah, I just remember playing it years ago and just being just enthralled with it at the time. It was, I had just got my PlayStation 2 and I'm going through this catalog of games. And I found that one. I'm like, oh, I never played this one before. Everyone always talked it up. And then back then, it was just absolutely incredible at the time. It's just one of those games where you could, I think I did actually play it all in one weekend. Like, I just couldn't stop playing it because it was just so engaging and so fun. And replaying it, I'm just so happy that this game just still rules. It just is absolutely a blast to play. That progression from literally punching dogs in the face at the beginning of the game. After Death calls you a punk kid and takes away all your powers, you are literally punching dogs until you finally start getting better weapons, to really being a vampire menace at the end of the game. You are just wrecking everything in your path except for the final boss towards the end. And just that build and that discovery element just continues to work so well. And I think a big part of that is because it is a pretty fast game. It's not slow paced. You are moving through these rooms, and that clip really helps, you know, keep you going. And the save spots are just far enough apart where you're like, okay, I'm going to save here, but I got to keep going, right? I got to keep trying to get more stuff. I have to find more things in here. It's just expertly paced, and that pacing just continues to hold to this day. And, I mean, we're talking about it. It's a 1997 game, and this thing just has aged incredibly well. The graphics and the music are just fantastic. But the design of the castle itself is just so exemplary of that genre that this thing, people will always be able to play this. It's just never going to lose that touch. And then, as David was mentioning earlier, all those little details, that sense of humor this game has just holds everything together so well. It's just, it's when you're not finding a new power up, you're uncovering a new enemy that will probably make you laugh the first time you face them. It's just hilarious what you encounter in this game. And so you have all these different elements coming together just to make a game that is just continues to be really a high watermark of this genre.
Yeah, totally agree. The two things that stand out to me the most, or at least that, you know, you guys have touched on, the sound design and the enemy design. There are so many different enemies in this game. Like, every time you go to a different room, you find new enemies. Like, there's a couple of palette swaps with some of the skeletons and some of the knights, but for the most part, you're finding different enemies that do different things. There, even later in the game, when you're super powerful, there are still a few enemies that can give you a lot of trouble, be really annoying. One that I remembered was it's this girl, this plant girl, yes, who kind of like rises out of the center of a plant, and she has these tendrils or tentacles that shoot out of the ground, and she also throws like roses at you. I'm just like ripping my hair out. Like, I hate this enemy so much. Like, it was the only one really. I'm super powerful. I've leveled up a ton. My equipment is great. This plant woman can still wreck me. Until I figured out, or until I picked up the holy water sub weapon, and I just throw the holy water in the middle, and it just burns her to death. But often she would be paired with another annoying.
Boulder.
The bomb throwing enemy, or some like another kind of troll like enemy, and so just the pair of them together in these tight corridors was exceedingly frustrating. But the fact that that came up later in the game, when I already thought I was so strong, a moment would come up where I felt a little bit weaker again, or I felt like I had to strategize again. So I thought that was really neat. Just so many different enemies thrown at you, and most of them are like one-hit kills. They're really weak, or they're funny, or they look, speaking of sound design, the death sounds that come from the enemies are hilarious. Like, some of them are so exaggerated and overblown. The shrieks of some of the ice spirits and like harpy-like creatures, like some of them are just outrageous. And it's this that's the attention detail. That's the small things that they don't really, they're certainly not gameplay. You don't need them, but they just add so much character to this game. And I think that's what it has. And maybe that's another big way that it holds up today. It just has so much character and uniqueness to it. It is a Metroidvania. You do see, you know, familiar things from Castlevania games, from Metroid games, from RPGs, but the sum of all those parts just culminate in such a fantastic, memorable product. Like, I can't believe how much I liked this game, and I also can't believe that I waited this long to play it, and that really everyone who said a good thing about this game, none of them were wrong. No one was exaggerating. This is a masterpiece of the genre, and it may be the best Metroidvania ever. Like, that's how much I like this game, and how much you can see its influence in other games.
Well, even on like the PlayStation 5, like you said, those shrieks from the enemies when you defeat them, like, that screams out to you out of the controller. Like, that, it actually startled me the first time, because it's like, wah, what the hell? Like, it's loud.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you said, some of those enemy designs are hilarious. Like, there's the one where there's like two skeletons with a stick, and then there's like a head that shoots fire on the stick. But the hilarious thing is,
that's one of my favorites.
If you kill the head that's on the stick on that's being like, it's, I think they're called like Ark of the Covenant skeletons or something. And it's like, so when you kill the thing that they're holding, they actually like run around with their arms in the air, like shrieking because they're worried they're about to die. Like, it's so funny.
Right.
And then the librarian was hilarious to me because, you know, Alucard walks in and he's like, "Yeah, you're gonna help me out." And he's like, "Oh no, I could never turn on the master." And he goes, "You'll be graciously rewarded. Well, let's see what we have here." You know, like, it was just hilarious that too. And
yeah,
there's just so many little details like that. And then to go back to the save points too, it's funny that I'm kind of glad the hearts don't give you back your health, because the save points were almost like tests of endurance to a certain degree, because it's like, mm-hmm. unless you had, yeah. like, I guess there were potions and foods here and there and stuff, but for the most part, I found myself, it was like, okay, if I want to heal myself, I got to find the save. And especially at the beginning of the game, it's like, okay, like, I got to survive till I get to the save, and then I'm golden, you know? So it's like almost like these little mini games within the game where it's like, okay, this is I got to get A to B, and this is my focus.
It's interesting you bring up the save points. So when I first started playing this again, I had completely forgotten how to use the save points in the first place. And so I'm getting to these rooms. I'm like, okay, yeah, this is where you save. I remember that. I remember what you pressed to do this. And didn't even think to press up in the rooms.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
the first like hour and a half of the game was like white knuckle tension for me, because I'm down to like 10 hit points trying to like figure out what I'm supposed to do. Finally, I just stumbled into it and like, oh, I pressed up and it did the save animation. Like, you've got to be kidding me, this game. But you're absolutely right that it's designed so that you really don't need to use potions that much. And the rare exception being some boss fights or some of the more difficult enemies. And if you have a familiar that will... That's how I used them. The fairy just gave it to me. I'm like, okay, this is great. Otherwise, I didn't use it myself, because equipping them was kind of one of the flaws of the game.
Oh, the fairy too was another hilarious thing, because there was a time where I think I was looking for replying to something on my phone, or so I just kind of put the controller down for a second, and then when I came back, the fairy was sitting on my shoulder, and then when I moved, she shrieks and like falls off. And has to like catch herself midair so she doesn't fall on the ground. That was hilarious. The boss fights, the variety of the bosses was fantastic. Like, there are so many great bosses that were there. I think one of my favorites, just for variety's sake, was, I can't remember what it was called, but it was like four rooms big. Like, it was in the middle of the room, and you had to chop the chains off the ceiling to kind of take the armory goo off of the it's like an undead character or something. And I don't even think it was a necessary boss to fight the game. Like, this was, I think, just kind of like off the beaten path in the inverted castle, where there was like a decent inventory item or something. And
are you talking about the one where like the flies would come out and attack
yeah,
you?
Yeah, so
as you're like you're kind of taking pieces off of this thing, and then the flies are coming at that's Beelzebub.
Yeah, Beelzebub.
But I think great
that
boss was a great fight.
One. Yeah, that one's really good. Yeah.
And then
what I liked was that before the boss fights, often you would if you came from the right direction and you whipped the right lantern, you would get the sub weapon that is ideal for that boss. Mm-hmm. Like if you go into that boss with holy water, it's not going to do very much for you because holy water basically it's a ground based attack. But if you come from the right side, I came from the left actually, and then after I beat him, I saw of course on the right side of that the boss entrance. There is an axe, and an axe flies upward from your character. So it's perfect to fight this boss that is suspended from the ceiling. And the game does this a lot. It often gives you the right weapon for the job, and you have to, I guess, choose to take it or not, or whip. Make sure you're whipping every lantern to get the sub-weapons, to get the hearts to use it. And it's just so clever the way that it does that. I mean, we talked about the spacing of save points being so good, but the placement of weapons and power-ups is also very clever.
Well,
in
the
save
point, the save point is always, like, I think on almost every single boss, there is a save point very close to the boss, so that if you...
It might be, but you have to go left or right. If you choose the wrong direction, you get the boss fight. If you choose the right one, you get the save point, right?
Yep.
You got to recognize that room before the boss has that, or sometimes a couple times you can go into a room and you know it's a boss room. And if you quickly press to the left or right, you can exit the room before the boss fight actually starts. Other times, like the door will kind of shut behind you and you're trapped. But you just have to look for, again, little clues in the environment that tell you what's coming next.
Yeah, those forks in the road where you can tell a boss is coming up, but you need to save, were just, they were so tense, because I'm like, which way is it? Do you look at the map and you're like, which has more space? Like, maybe this way? And half the time it works.
Yes, that's right. It's good. I was going to say, I was looking at the Wikipedia for this, or the wiki for this game. In total, including bosses, 146 different enemies, at least I think in the version that we played, which is just, it's for a game from 1997, a PlayStation 1 game, that is staggering to me. I mean, that could be more than all three of the all of the Castlevania games combined before this, you know, like that's how just immense that number is. And you really do feel it. You feel like every part of the castle is different because the enemies are different. You start to recognize like the connection between the enemies and the area that you find them in, right? If it's a very vertical space, you're probably going to find skeletons throwing things down at you. The clock tower obviously has the Medusa heads and the there's two different types, and then there's those floating knights as well. Like they're just there's so many enemies this game. I can't believe it.
There's the so in the cavern, there's like four skeletons that are encapsulated in dirt, and you can see them, and they're just poking up with their spears because you have to go
past them. Yeah.
And then, but you can see there that there's water going under their feet. So if you push the block against the water hole, you watch them, and they even realize they're about to drown. And I burst out laughing watching them just struggle for their life until they finally exploded. That was, man.
I couldn't believe that was the solution to that puzzle of how to get through that room. To stop them from attacking upward and blocking your path, you have to drown them with that box. It's so ridiculous.
But that's what makes this game so good now. Like you said, that character, like a lesser game wouldn't have done that. A lesser game, you would, even if you did the drowning thing, it wouldn't have done the silly animation of them like dancing before dying. It's just that little extra bit that they added in that just makes everything connect so well.
I also appreciated that now there's no difficulty setting for this game, but they've made it with the different inventory items that you can find. It's almost like a choose your own difficulty just based on the equipment, because there's a couple weapons in this game where you just become an absolute nightmare. Like it was funny because I actually when I was playing through, I tried to not use a guide as much as possible because I wanted to kind of get a raw feeling of it. And so I was actually I was pretty much ready to fight Dracula and hadn't even come across the shield rod yet. So I like pretty much did most of the game without the shield rod, and then found out right before I went in there that the combination of the shield rod and Lucard's shield just basically makes him like a killing machine. Like it's, you just hold the shield up and you just, you're like a, what the juggernaut, I guess, that, you know, you're just running through and just wrecking characters. So it's one of those things. It's like, I know kind of these old games, these older games, you can get into this kind of funk where it's like you hit roadblocks where it's like, oh, this boss is so hard that it can frustrate you and maybe even make you just quit on the game because you're tired of it or whatever. But there's just things built into the game where it's like, okay, we want you to finish the game. So if you find this or if you level up or whatever, there's never going to be a point where it's like, okay, this game's too hard, I'm going to give up. But if you want to keep yourself, you know, with a good challenge, then just don't use particular weapons. You know, I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm.
And David, you found the chrysogram or whatever it is, that special sword. Because it's supposed to be exceedingly rare. Like, people can grind for hours and not get it, and you just randomly walked into the library and picked it up, right?
Like, and I knew, it's funny because I read about it. I read that exact thing. They're like, if you go to the library, there's like a particular spot where you can kind of like walk into the room, attack, and if it doesn't drop, you just go back out. And they're like, if you grind here for like a few hours, you might finally find one. And I'm like, oh man, I'm not doing that. it's too much for me. And I'm just running through, and then I see one of the drops, and it's the chrysogram. I'm like, what? And I was like, and it wrecks. It's like, it's crazy how powerful that weapon is. And it's funny because that's the best weapon to use against those Venus flytrap type ones that hit. Because it's basically like a turbo sword where he just like, he'll like do like seven stabs at like within the blink of an eye. So you can just, that's the, what I ended up using to get through that area, later in the game when I was, cause like I ended up beating the game, without exploring everything. And then I saw the ending and I just kind of was like, that's a strange ending. So then I like Googled it. And I'm like, oh, there's like multiple endings. so that's when I ended up. So to get the best ending, you have to explore both castles in their entirety. So that weapon was particularly useful in trying to get the 200%.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about the items is they're not all useful. Some of them are just really funny. Like one of my favorites is the sneakers, right? That you look at the description and it just says discreetly increases height. Like, what does that even do? So you put them on, and it just ever so slightly stretches out the sprite for Alucard. And that's it. That's all it does. It's just, there's also, like, sunglasses, and you look at the description. These are cool. Like, all right, those are cool. And that's it. That's all they do.
You can also change the color of his capes, I think. And so when he turns into a bat, like, he'll have a different color hue to him as well. Like, there's an item, I think, that lets you go into the options menu. You can change his appearance significantly, I guess. There was actually a trophy attached to that, so I did kind of play around with it a little bit. Yeah, I mean, what else can you say? Like, it's just such an impressive game. Like, the bosses are. I found a lot of the bosses easy, but I didn't hate that. I felt like it was kind of a reward for all the exploring I was doing, the leveling up, all the items that I had found. Figure out little tricks. Like David, you mentioned the shield rod, and there was one. The magic was one thing that I thought was kind of funny in this game. I meant to bring that up. The fact that there are magic spells you can cast even if you don't have the book teaching you how to do it. Like the librarian sells magic spells from books, and you know they're kind of like fighting game inputs. For example, like one of them, you start from the left of the D-pad in theory and go do like a semicircle to the right. And then you'll turn on like this ability that lets Alucard heal back if he attacks enemies that draw blood from. Yeah, if they bleed, awesome. Then you get health back. So when I picked that up and I found, I was finding more enemies, I was like, oh, does this person bleed? Does it depend on which weapon I'm using? Bats are a good one to heal off of because there's usually a lot of them. They're super weak and they do bleed. So if you find a bat room, that could almost be like a healing room for you. So that was kind of cool. But there's other spells too that you can just do. If you know the input after you've beaten the game or you look it up or whatever, you can just do the spell even if you haven't bought the book. I bought the book from the librarian, so that was kind of neat too. Just a lot of... There's a ton of things you could do in this game. You could finish it and then go back and play it completely differently. And we haven't even talked about, like, we mentioned the multiple endings, but there's different characters you can use as well. There's a staggering amount of content in this package.
Well, and just the fact that you can switch between a bat, a wolf, or just a literal cloud. Like, that blew my mind.
That's right.
Used the cloud.
For the longest time, I didn't even know what the wolf did. Like, I didn't know, why would I use this wolf character? And then I found a couple of uses for him when I was trying to get to 100, 196 or 200% or whatever, that he could swim, right? That's one of the helpful things.
There was, like, one hallway, I think, that he was useful to get down because, like, I think you had to be short to get through it or something, and...
There's a couple of corridors where the height, you have to be a little bit shorter and the wolf can go in there. Yeah. Maybe we just in the interest of time, we could move on to a little bit of comparison. So we've talked about Symphony of the Night, but what about comparing it to other games in the genre, other Metroidvanias? Chris, maybe you want to kick us off here with this topic.
Yeah, I mean, this is still great, and I'm inclined to still say that this is still the best, just because it's almost, it's that old and you could still play it and have a blast, and that's never going to change. This is always going to be, even more than I would say Super Metroid, this is the one that I think people tend to compare things to see how good is a Metroidvania right now. And I think that's fair. I think it really is the high water mark of this genre. Mm-hmm. It's still a product of its time, so people need to be aware of that. The CGI scenes are 1997 PlayStation, which I think are great, but they might not, they don't match modern standards anymore. The only thing that I think really holds this game back, other than the aforementioned flying enemies in the Castlevania series, it's just the hallmark of that genre. The Medusa heads will get you. That clock tower will get you. They're never fun.
Yep.
And where other Metroidvanias have made great strides is that inventory system. It's really clunky in this.
Yeah.
And I think even the GBA games have made improvements in that. I haven't played them in many years either, so I can't remember fully, but that inventory system, it was hard a little bit for me to rewire my brain a little bit to keep going in equipping what I need, just especially for like potions and one use items like that, because you technically have to assign it to your hand and then you use it. But then if you want something else in that hand, you have to go back to the inventory and put something there. It's really clunky. It doesn't detract too much from the game, but that's one area where modern games obviously have taken it and made better.
I think that it's fortunate that you don't necessarily need the healing items in this game. Like, you can use them for sure. And as you mentioned, it is clunky to do so. But fortunately, the way the save points are spread out, and with that bleeding healing spell that I mentioned, like, there are ways around using the item, so you can kind of eschew that if you are so inclined. But yeah, it is bad. The having to equip items in a hand, taking out a shield that you're using, use the item, go back, put the shield on, it doesn't work very well. Like, yeah, definitely a product of its time and something that they would improve upon. For my comparison, like, I agree with you, Chris. I think it's hard not to consider this kind of the gold standard. It is absolutely up there. I think the combat can be too easy depending on how you play the game. Like, I don't think I was going out of my way to grind. I was trying to find most things that I could. I was exploring fairly thoroughly, and I still found a lot of the bosses easy. The only times I didn't was when I maybe went in a direction I shouldn't have, or I don't know. I went, for example, in the second castle, I went on the left side as opposed to the right side, and I came across a duplicate fight with Alucard. You're fighting your reflection, basically, and he gave me some trouble. And I feel like I probably should have gone the other way to get to that fight, maybe. But other than that, and then a couple of late game bosses, which we'll talk about in the spoiler section coming up, I didn't have too much trouble. So I guess I was hoping for maybe a little bit more overall challenge. The atmosphere, sound design, just excellent throughout. Just constantly enamored with both. The twist, which we'll talk about in more detail, incredible. There are multiple playable characters, and you could even start the game with them if you knew the code to put in as your name. Secrets of the Castle just adds so much. There's just so much to do. There's so many weapons and things you probably didn't find your first time through. All the familiars, all the abilities, everything like that. So I can definitely put it up there with Hollow Knight, Axiom Verge. Like, I think those are kind of pinnacles of the indie produced Metroidvanias. But yeah, this one from a AAA standpoint, it's hard to deny its place. I still think I probably put Super Metroid just a little bit above it because it's so tight. This one, there are some loose sections, I guess. But it's fantastic, and again, it gives you so much. So much more meat on the bone than Super Metroid does. So, David, what about you? You've got, in the notes, you've put a man with his hands up in the air, that emoji. So maybe you can expound on that.
Well, it's my biggest concern at this point is that I've played the best one there is, and it's all downhill from here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is a definite risk. But I've played a few of these. Like, I played Castlevania 4, and maybe I just didn't get far enough because I just wasn't vibing with that one. I have actually played the Bloodstained Ritual of the Night. Like, I played a few hours of that, and I don't know, again, like, it just didn't have the same feel. It just felt a little clunky, a little slow. The combat just didn't feel as silky smooth. Like I said, the Metroid ones I didn't really get into, so I was looking into some of the better Metroidvanias just to see, like, because I don't want to fall too far off the tree here. And yeah, I came across, like, people said, you know, the Hollow Knight is, and Axiom Verge are usually, like you said, the indie go-tos. I've also heard, like, Chasm, mm-hmm. The Time Spinner, and then even someone like Yi had mentioned, like, Dead Cells, which is, it's not really a Metroidvania. Sure. Yeah, I would say it's, like, a more linear one. It's because there are different paths you can take when you get certain items. So it is a little bit that way, but to me, it's like, there's no, you're not going back though, really. Like, you're always going in one direction in mm-hmm. Dead Cells. But the thing is like, that's what I want. Like, I want the combat of something like Dead Cells, but the level design of Symphony of the Night, where it's like, okay, now I'm heading back to places I've been before, and, you know, the enemies that gave me trouble before, now it's reckon time. Like, now you get your just desserts.
Yeah.
Like, there, you kind of lose that in Dead Cells, so it's, or you don't really have it. So it's, that's kind of something that I wanted to get there. But, and then the other unfortunate part is it seems like this might be the end of Castlevania because, like, it's Konami who barely makes video games anymore. And, like, the last Castlevania that was made, or I think, like, the last two or three were all Mercury Steam, and they were all kind of like 3D style. Like, they weren't the 2D style, they're 3D, and I'm not high on Mercury Steam. Like, I haven't played Dread, but I couldn't, like, Samus Returns is awful. I gave up on that after a few hours. It's just I don't jive with that design philosophy. So going back to, like, the last Castlevania, I don't think is going to make a lot of sense, because it's like, if I didn't like all these other Mercury Steam games, I can't imagine I'm going to like this one. So a little disappointed that way, but it's definitely a genre I'm going to be, like, some of these indie ones that we talked about, I think I'm going to give them a go and see how it goes, because it's one of these things where it's like, because I haven't played them before, this is pretty interesting now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bloodstained is probably the best comparison given the people that worked on it, so that you've already got that DNA. Bloodstained is slower. Like, Bloodstained is, it's slower. It's a little more methodical than this game. Like, this game, you know, Alucard moves. The way he moves, the way he jumps, everything is a little bit more expedited. Combat feels mm-hmm. faster. I like the challenge of Bloodstained compared to Symphony of the Night. I felt like the challenge of the combat in Bloodstained was a little bit better. I liked the way that you gained new abilities, even though it was kind of random. I guess there are other Castlevania games where it's a little bit random too. But Bloodstained is probably the one you want to compare matter the most to. So you could give that another try, David. They are working on, I believe Iga is working on another Bloodstained. There's a sequel to that game. So maybe that'll fix some of the issues you had with the original and maybe even bring it closer to Symphony of the Night. That'd be cool. I want to get into a quick spoiler discussion here. So if no one, if you haven't played this yet, you know, we're going to probably talk about the endings and all the different little things that we found that we would consider spoilerish, some of the final bosses and stuff. So if you don't want to hear that, maybe turn out for 5 minutes and then come back for last call, where we're going to talk about if which of us are more into the Metroid side or the Castlevania side, Metroidvanias. But yeah, so some spoiler talk. I don't know who wants to start. David, do you want to kick us off here? Like, what you thought about the endings, or the inverted castle itself, like wherever you want to go here.
Well, the inverted castle was quite surprising to me, because you wouldn't expect the level design to still maintain itself in the second half, because you're like, well, it's upside down, it's kind of lazy, they just wanted to save space or whatever on the discs, and this was their way around it. But then you're going through it and you're like, wow, this works. Why does this work? Like, it's exactly the same. It's literally upside down. How did they do this? Like, they must have gone through this so thoroughly that it still works even upside down. It feels just as good. It was so surprising to me.
I mean, they had to design the castle the first way around that it would also work in reverse, yeah, or inverted. Like, it's just that they would think to do that. That's how you could. I'm sure people played this game, beat Richter the first time, and thought, "Oh, yep, that's it. Pretty good game." And then you in your playground discussion with your friends, a couple of the players are playing it, and they're like, "Do you know there's another castle?" And you get into that discussion, you're like, "Oh my gosh!" Like, there's a whole other. The game duplicates, yep, basically. There's a whole other game after what is one ending of the game, and could have been, for some people, the ending that they reached and just decided that was it. So I just think that's
and
amazing.
It is 50-50. Yeah. Like, I also thought there it's going to be, like, you know, just a little bit of a bonus, but it was like the game duplicated, literally. Like, it was crazy.
It does. Yeah, it's another whole game.
Yeah, it's just the fact that, like you said, you can miss it. You could beat Richter, yes, and then never know about it. And that's just incredible. And then but like David was saying, it's just how effortlessly playing that inverted castle, mm-hmm, and then realizing, yes, it's flipped. Yes. It's just a masterpiece in level design for that. I don't know how they did it. It's just incredible. That's...
I mean, I suppose a lot of it is facilitated by the fact that you have the bat power, you have the high jump, and so a lot of the places that maybe would be tricky in the inverted style, you're not going to platform your way out of this, you're going to fly up with the bat. You have tools in your kit to be able to make traversal that much easier. Like, in the regular style castle, you can get around with ease once you're powered up. But in the inverted castle, you do have to switch to bat in quite a few spots or use your high jump to its fullest to get around. But you have that capability now, so you're able to do that. So it doesn't feel like, you know, you're doing any tricky platforming or anything like that. There's a lot of platforming in the game at all. But the maneuverability just feels as fluid as it did before because you have all the tools to do that. But I mean, getting to the inverted castle, like, you have to read the ring. The rings have a little comment on them, and if you read them together, you can kind of piece what they're looking for. You have to bring the two rings to the middle of the castle, basically, where there's a giant clock. The giant clock actually is a really interesting room because it's so ominous. With the first time you come to it, you can see all the different paths that branch out of it. You know, I think you meet Maria there one of the first times you get there, mm-hmm, as well. So you get the sense that this room is going to be important. And then you're probably going to walk through it yourself multiple times, and you'll see that one of the exits to the room where you can fall down to the left or the right might be open. I don't even know what the impetus behind those openings is. Like, is it a certain time when they're open? Do you have to come from a certain direction, Chris? Do you know?
I think it's just based on a number of the ticks of the clock. I think you have to wait just a number, and then the one side will open, and if you have the ability, you can get up there.
I think you can trigger. Gotcha. Yeah, I think you can trigger it opening with the time manipulating sub weapon.
Okay. The pocket watch.
Yeah, like when you freeze time. Like, I think if you go into that room and freeze time, it will open the one gate that's usually on, like, a time-based mechanism. Yeah.
Right. That's hilarious. Yeah. What another little clever thing that you discover, yeah. Right? But like, you have to get to the second castle, you have to do everything in that first castle pretty much. You need to get the spike armor, to get the silver ring, you need to go, you know, you fight the succubus, which is I feel like it's kind of like a hidden boss. You don't need to fight her to beat Richter the first time. Then you get the gold ring. I thought that was a really cool scene with Alucard's mother, and then it, turning out to be the succubus, right? He could tell by the way she was talking. Like, she's like, she was saying something about, like, you know, basically kill all the humans or something like that. One of the most challenging boss, I thought, was not Dracula, but it starts with a G. He's in the top right corner of the inverted castle. He's as tall as the whole screen, and he's got like these lightning attacks. You guys know who I'm talking about?
Yeah, that one was really hard.
I can't remember his name, but it's not Gilgamesh, but it's something in that. It's something like that. I'm gonna look it up here, but I don't know if you guys. I tried to fight him the first time without the armor, but it's impossible.
I'm pretty sure it's Gallimoth, because that's the one. That's the kid Dracula final boss. Because when you beat him, there's like a kid Dracula achievement. I can't remember what it's called.
So Gilgamoth is one of many bosses from previous Castlevania games that show up, especially in the inverted castle. You actually fight a version of Trevor, Sypha, and Grant in a single fight, which is kind of a cool one. I didn't find it particularly hard, but those are the three characters from Castlevania 3. And they were also, at least Sypha and Trevor were characters in the Castlevania show on Netflix as well. But there's other bosses. I think some of the original bosses from the first Castlevania game show up in the inverted castle. It's kind of a tribute to the Castlevania games that came before it. And that's another thing that makes the inverted castle such a special place. And a shame that some people wouldn't even see it.
Yeah.
And just to go up the spoilers, one of my favorite moments from this game, when you're making reference to previous Castlevanias, is there's one dialogue with Maria where they're talking, and he talks about the Belmont clan, and a little thought bubble comes up, and an 8-bit sprite of Trevor Belmont pops in, just hanging out there.
Right. it's so random.
This is fantastic. It's just like, he's thinking of Trevor, and that's what he thinks of, the 8-bit sprite. It's great.
Like, if you've played other Castlevania games, there's just a lot of those nice little throwbacks to what came before, and I love when those things are baked in, especially when they're a little bit hidden. You know, they're not so obvious. You kind of have to dig around for them. But for so many of them being in the inverted castle, it just felt like a great reward for doing everything the first time through the game, beating Richter, attacking that orb above him, and then eventually getting to the final fight. I mean, you have to almost believe that people would be surprised if you played the game through and didn't fight Dracula. And you're fighting Richter as the final boss. It just seems kind of weird, right? Like, why am I fighting this Belmont? You get this ending that doesn't feel super satisfying, and then you get I think, David, you made a joke about how the best ending adds like another 15 or 20 seconds or something that doesn't really add a lot to. I think you basically just see the castle implode, basically, or you get destroyed by light.
Not even that.
Right?
Like, it's so you see all that. Regardless, the only difference between the two is that in the good ending, Alucard says, like, he's gonna, the best thing for him to do is to be out of sight, like to leave the humans to whatever. And then Richter and Maria are kind of standing there, and Richter's like, you're not gonna go after him, and Maria's like, yeah, he's better off. And then that's it. And then in the best ending, Richter says, tells her, like, you should go after him, and Maria's like, oh, thank you for understanding. Want to help him, and she leaves to go get him. So it's not huge, but I mean, part of that though is like throughout the entire game, like, there wasn't a whole lot of story bits, but the stuff that was there was impactful to me. Like it
was really interesting to run into Maria, or run into I get, you know, even dialogue you get from Richter, or what's that other character's name that the boss,
the one right before Dracula, like when
Shaft.
Yeah.
Shaft,
that's right.
Stuff like that, or the discussion. Oh, when he sees Richter, the fight with like the Minotaur boss, where he first meets Richter, and he's like, that smell, that blood smell, you're a Belmont. And to see that, and the succubus one was, I thought, was really good, because it showed him with his mother. And then, yeah. Well, and then you, even at the beginning of the game, you have that iconic scene where Dracula's like just kind of chilling on his chair, like bored out of his mind, and he like flings the wine glass right. off. And then, yeah, and then the final boss with Dracula, where, you know, Dracula still wants him, like, you know, come be by my side so we can rule, and Alucard's like, or I better chuckle with that one. But yeah, like it was just those scenes I thought were great. Or even when he meets Death at the beginning too, and Death's mm-hmm. like, you impotent, you're impudent child, like, you know, stuff. I don't know. I just, like I said, you didn't get a ton of story, but the stuff that you did, it basically spelled out what was going on in the game succinctly, and was impactful for, you know, the moments that it showed.
I did want to mention one thing before we get to the last call, that you can play the game as Maria and Richter. I haven't tried that yet, but you just put in their names in the name select of the game at the beginning of the game, and then you start the game as those characters. So another way to add longevity to the title, you can actually play as different characters.
Yeah, I was going
to
ask about that, because I know one of the achievements is to beat Shaft as Richter. And I was thinking, like, well, how do I switch to Richter? Do I, like, is there a room I have to go to? And then we, like, tag out, or, like, what's the deal? So, yeah, I have to look into
it. I think you put his name in, or the cheat codes are listed online somewhere.
Okay.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol. Get going.
Yeah, let's wrap up the spoiler talk there. So now we've got our last call. Are you more into the Metroid side or the Castlevania side of Metroidvanias? Like, what really, on a Metroidvania, when you're playing one, you're enjoying it, which, you know, trappings do you really lean towards, or do you look forward to, maybe? Chris, we'll start with you for this one.
Yeah, and it just, when this discourse happens a lot, it's often paired as a dichotomy, right? And it really shouldn't mm-hmm. be. Obviously, Metroid is a fantastic series, and what Symphony of the Night, what was really so special about it is the way they took that formula and just layered those RPG mechanics onto it to make something brand new and exciting. And when we get into those Metroidvania discussions, I feel like that tradition of taking that formula and adding new things into it is really where I think the most interesting games are found. You know, so the biggest one lately has been Hollow Knight, right? And what that was famous mm-hmm. for is adding in a lot of the design lessons from Dark Souls into the mix. But there's other ones too. My favorite might be Yoku's Island Express, which takes Metroid and adds pinball, of all things, into it. And it is just beautiful. It's a fantastic game. David, you were asking earlier about which ones you might like. You might like a game, Guacamelee, if you haven't tried that before, because that takes the Metroidvania formula and adds brawler mechanics into it. And it's super fast and super fun. It's really engaging. But there are still that don't add really much new. You know, Axiom Verge is basically Metroid with just different abilities, right? And mm-hmm. that is a great game. I haven't played the second one yet, so I'm not sure. But that first one is just it's a clone of Metroid, and it does that exceptionally well. Cave Story doesn't really add a ton to the formula, but it nails that exploration and progression extremely well. And so, Jordan, I think I agree with what you were saying. Is like, it's less of a dichotomy between those two, and mm-hmm. more of like, well, what type of flavor do you want, right? Do you still want that core Metroid experience? Well, you know, we just got Metroid Dread. I haven't played that yet, but that's Metroid. It's just a Metroid formula through and through. But then on the indie scene, especially, you have all these interesting ways that they're taking that formula and trying different things with it, which is hearkening back to what Symphony of the Night did way back in 1997.
Yeah, I like bringing up the idea of not making things a dichotomy, because everyone wants to make everything a dichotomy, and that's a problem. But the idea of a flavor is great, and I think that maybe you prefer... And now there's so many different ways that... And you've mentioned a lot of good examples, Chris, of ways that people have taken Metroidvania trappings and layered them on top of something else to give it this new flavor, and I think that's great. David, what about you? I know you don't really play a lot of these games, but what is it? Kind of what elements are you looking for to make a really good Metroidvania? Maybe?
Yeah. Oh, I was just actually gonna say, like, I'll take the opposite view and say I don't like Metroid or Vania. So, sure. You know, I'll take neither. I just want, like, the things that I want out of like, I'm a Symphony of the Night fan, I guess would be the way to put it. And if I was to play another game in this kind of light or the style, I definitely would want, like, the RPG mechanics to stay there, because I really enjoy the process of becoming more powerful throughout the game, and not just necessarily, like, oh, finding this weapon that's stronger or that weapon that's stronger. Like, I really like that the health starts off low and then gets higher as the game goes on. I like that you damage enemies less, and then your strength is growing as you go through, because I really love going back to places where you start the game off, and then, you know, these enemies that maybe took 3 or 4 or 5 hits are now just like one a smack and my mom my way. Like, I love that feeling of growing stronger throughout the game. I also enjoy I want something that's a little bit faster. The Dead Cells style of combat is fantastic. Like, Katana Zero is not really a Metroidvania, but it's still kind of that same 2D style of attacking. There's also, like, Cyber Shadow. Like, these are the types of quick, you know, jumping and using items and stuff. Like, that's something I really enjoy. So yeah, it's just stuff like those are the elements that I kind of want to have. Like, it's and then, like I said, the exploration of it's so difficult to do the dungeon design, and sometimes I'll see, like, procedurally generated, and I'm like, you know, like, because I'm looking at Symphony of the Night and I'm like, you know, a computer couldn't make it this good. So it always, like, gives me pause when I see something to the effect of exploring this procedurally generated area. It's like, so.
But then you like Dead Cells, right? Like, yeah. And that is procedurally generated or randomized.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, though, is it has enough of the elements that it's really fun. Like, it has the combat. It has the design of allowing you to kind of go to different places depending on the items that you found or the drops that you've picked up. But yeah, it loses a little bit of its character with being completely linear. Like, you're only going one way, really. Like, it's, you're always going ahead. You're never coming back to where you were before. And yeah, right. Like you said, it's procedurally generated. So there's going to be, you can't go by memory later on. Like, it's going to be a whole new area.
Yeah, it's funny for Chris, you and Chris to take opposite stances here, I suppose. I would have said before this talk, before I even thought about a question, I prefer the Metroid side. But it's tough. Then I play Symphony of the Night, and I'm like, man, I really like the Castlevania side now. And it feels like a push and pull to me. Like, there are sometimes where I'm more in the mood for a Metroid style game, and sometimes more in the mood for a Castlevania style game. Of course, you know, during October, in the fall season, like, Castlevania is a lot of fun because it feels thematically appropriate. It feels satisfying to play games that involve skeletons and blood and vampires and things like that. Symphony of the Night comes off of, like, I finished that and then I played Metroid Dread right after, and I love both of them for different reasons. But for me, maybe it's just a mood. Like, maybe I just want to be able to play one game or the other, depending on how I'm feeling. I don't know if I can give more than that. Like, sometimes, like, a Castlevania game, like, if a little bit slower and I want something more fast paced, that's not going to work. Like, Metroid is also more about it's space, right? It's a whole different kind of. Sci-fi is very, very different from, like, horror or fantasy, right? And so I guess for me, that's the kind of distinction I would make sometimes between these, is that, you know, maybe you're more in the mood for one of those. They're still going to do the backtracking thing. They're still going to do the powering up thing. I suppose in Dread, I found a little bit that even with the boss fights, I'm at the end of the game, I'm feeling very powerful. I still... You know, the bosses can still take you out pretty quickly, but in Symphony of the Night, for example, like, Dracula, you know, as powerful as he might be at the end of the game, or any of the bosses near the end of the game, like, it's not it's not like two or three hits and you're dead. It's a little bit different. So, yeah, I'm rambling a little bit, but I like both. I don't know that I'm probably in the middle, and then depending on the season or the day of the week, I might lean more to one side or the other.
What's funny is, aside from Federation Force, the Metroid versus Vania from 2010 or 2011, I guess, ever since 2011, every game in either series has been developed by Mercury Steam.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
So it's gotten to the point where it's like, you know, they're basically the same. It's the same developer. So you're really only talking about like the history as opposed to the future, because everything in the past 10 years besides that one Metroid game has been a Mercury Steam developed.
Well, what's funny is that so many independent developers are making games in this style, right? Like, that's why you're not going to have larger companies making Metroidvanias necessarily, because there's such a glut of them on every digital storefront. And why would you spend a big budget when you can make a good one with a smaller budget, right? I think that's part of it. Like, I think of a smaller budget game published by Devolver, Gato Roboto. Gato Roboto is very much a Metroid game. It's even hard to call it a Metroidvania. It's just a Metroid game. But it's excellent. You know, you can finish it in a couple hours. It's black and white. I think there might be red color. You might be able to do palette swaps or whatever. But it's fairly basic Metroid. But sometimes when you get down to the kind of the bare roots of these games, that's really all you need. But that's just what I wanted to shout out. I guess what came to my mind when I thought about Gato Roboto is what I like about these games is when they're tight. I like when the pacing is great, that you're not slogging away for hours. And David, you're right. Like, I think I think Samus Returns is too slow. I think it's a really long game. Dread is a lot tighter of a game than that one is. So I think they really fixed. I think Mercury's name really fixed them things with Samus Returns that didn't go as well, and did a better job with them in Dread. It feels a lot faster, better paced. But maybe we'll wrap it up there. You know, good discussion on Symphony of the Night, Metroidvanias as a whole, some of the different things, different examples of the games in that genre that we like. Chris, you know, first time on the podcast, if people want to catch up with you or find what you're doing, where can they do that? Where can people find
you? Yeah, you can see my reviews and anything else I write on the Thirsty Mage website. I'm going to try to do more article style things a little bit, there's not a lot of reviews coming. So I did put up a piece recently about the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, and that's development in video games and some recent examples to play that, because we often talk about the important role of Dungeons and Dragons in video games, but, you know, Call of Cthulhu is a very important tabletop role-playing game, and I believe it's actually the most popular one in Japan right now. And that did have some pretty significant impact on the development of video games as well. So that's on the Thirsty Mage right now. You can always find me on Twitter at ReadChrisR. I don't really do much on Twitter, just retweet stuff that, honestly, you guys do a lot. But that's where I'm at.
Cool, sounds good. David, what's going on with you? How's the magazine coming? I know you've been, I don't know if that's public knowledge, but I know Thirsty Mage patrons, listeners, people in the Discord have definitely heard about the magazine. What's going on with you?
So the magazine's coming around. It's kind of evolved from its initial, like my initial idea about it in September, where you know, it was gonna, I started off with like 40 or so pages, and then all of a sudden my table of contents started expanding to like 60 and 80, and then to the point where I'm like, okay, I'm not gonna get this done until probably the end of the year, so maybe this will be kind of like an annual summary of 2021, and that's kind of where we're sitting at now. So I've got a bunch of pages completed. So it's basically just a mix of reviews that we've done throughout the year, along with some new features and different articles and of that nature. I know, Jordan, you've got an article about the open world design and the mini games of Yakuza Like a Dragon. I'm just finishing up kind of a letter or two of like why I'm obsessed with the Trails trilogy or the Trails series, Legend of Heroes. So obviously there's going to be an article about that. I've got...
I thought that'd be half the magazine or something.
It's, yeah, the pages for that one are just spiraling out of control. We got a bunch of reviews that we've done that are I've put together with different graphics and that sort of thing. And then also I'm going to have a listing of the different like Vita and PSP and like RPGs that might be lost but to time, because it seems like we're those digital storefronts are on a death spiral. So kind of to give people a checklist if there's anything that they've missed that they might want to jump on. So yeah, so I'm hoping to have that done by the end of the year. That will be like, there'll be a digital copy available to patrons for sure, and depending on the demand, we'll see where we go from there.
Yeah, sounds good. Yeah, I can't wait for that to come out. Obviously, looking forward to that. I just put up a review today. So again, we're recording on Wednesday the 27th. I put up a review for Voice of Cards, a game we talked about a few weeks ago when we play Yumi and Paige played the demo. I can't remember if Casey played it as well. Chris, have you seen Voice of Cards or played the demo for
that one? I did play the demo, so I was looking forward to reading a review of it. Just haven't had a chance to do that yet.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I put up a written written and video review. You can check those out on NintendoWorldReport.com. If you catch me on Twitter, at Wristman64, I was also taking questions about the game. I've played it through a couple times. I'm actually just trying to collect all the cards that I can in the game. There are a few little extra things you can do once you've seen the story through, multiple endings and things like that. So that's kind of a neat thing, but check out the review if you have questions about the game. If you're not sure if you want to get into it, just hit me up on Twitter. But yeah, I think that'll do it for our Symphony of the Night episodes. Hope everyone enjoyed listening to us discuss what is just a fantastic game that we're all kind of blown away by, it sounds like. And yeah, that'll do it for this episode. So thanks for everyone for listening. Thanks to Chris for joining us. Hopefully we'll have him on again soon. And yeah, that'll do it. So goodbye, everybody.
Bye.